of trade, investment, and profit. Between 1500 and 1600 alone, Europeans recorded carrying back to Europe from the Americas nearly 200 tons of gold and 16,000 tons of silver. Much more traveled as contraband. The discovery of America and that of a passage to the East Indies by the Cape of Good Hope are the two greatest and most important events recorded in the history of mankind, Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations in 1776. But the voyages of Columbus and Diaz also marked a turning point in the development of another economic system, slavery. The wealth of the Americas flowed to Europe by the forced labor of Africans. Slavery had been practiced in many parts of the world for centuries. People tended to enslave their enemies, people they considered different enough from themselves to condemn to lifelong servitude. Sometimes, though not often, the status of slaves was heritable. The children of slaves were condemned to a life of slavery, too. Many wars had to do with religion, and because many slaves were prisoners of war, slaves and their owners tended to be people of different faiths. Christians enslaved Jews, Muslims enslaved Christians, Christians enslaved Muslims. Since the Middle Ages, Muslim traders from North Africa had traded in Africans from below the Sahara, where slavery was widespread. In much of Africa, labor, not land, constituted the sole form of property recognized by law, a form of consolidating wealth and generating revenue, which meant that African states tended to be small, and that while European wars were fought for land, African wars were fought for labor. People captured in African wars were bought and sold in large markets by merchants and local officials and kings, and, beginning in the 1450s, by Portuguese sea captains. Columbus, a veteran of that trade, reported to Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492 that it would be the work of a moment to enslave the people of Haiti, since, with 50 men, all of them could be held in subjection and can be made to do whatever one might wish. In sugar mines and gold mines, the Spanish worked their native slaves to death, while many more died of disease. Soon, they turned to another source of forced labor, Africans traded by the Portuguese. Counting and keeping accounts of the cargo of every ship, Europeans found themselves puzzled by an extraordinary asymmetry. People moved from Europe and Africa to the Americas, wealth moved from the Americas to Europe, and animals and plants moved from Europe to the Americas. But very few people or animals or plants moved from the Americas to Europe or Africa, at least not successfully. It appears as if some invisible barrier existed preventing passage eastward, though allowing it westward, a later botanist wrote. The one-way migration of people made self-evident sense. People controlled the ships, and they carried far more people west than east, bringing soldiers and missionaries, settlers and slaves. But the one-way migration of animals and plants was for centuries, until the late 19th century Age of Darwin in the germ theory of disease, altogether baffling, explained only by faith in divine providence. Christians took it as a sign that their conquest was ordained by God. The signs came in abundance. When Columbus made a second voyage across the ocean in 1493, he commanded a fleet of 17 ships carrying 1,200 men, and another kind of army too, seeds and cuttings of wheat, chickpeas, melons, onions, radishes, greens, grapevines, and sugarcane, and horses, pigs, cattle, chickens, sheep, and goats, male and female, two by two. Hidden among the men and the plants and the animals were stowaways, seeds stuck to animal skins or clinging to the folds of cloaks and blankets and clods of mud. Most of these were the seeds of plants Europeans considered to be weeds, like bluegrass, daisies, thistles, nettles, ferns, and dandelions. Weeds grow best in disturbed soil, and nothing disturbs soil better than an army of men, raising forests for timber and fuel, and turning up the ground cover with their boots and the hooves of their horses and oxen and cattle. Livestock eat grass, people eat livestock. Livestock turn grass into food that humans can eat. The animals that Europeans brought to the New World, cattle, pigs, goats, sheep, chickens, and horses, had no natural predators in the Americas, but they did have an abundant food supply. They reproduced in numbers unfathomable in Europe. Cattle populations doubled every 15 months. Nothing, though, beat the pigs. Pigs convert one-fifth of everything they eat into food for human consumption. Cattle, by contrast, convert one-twentieth. They feed themselves by foraging, and they have litters of 10 or more. Within a few years of Columbus's second voyage, the 8 pigs he brought with him had descendants numbering in the thousands. Wrote one observer, "All the mountains swarmed with them." Meanwhile, the people of the New World, they died by the hundreds, they died by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, by the hundreds of thousands, by the tens of millions. The isolation of the Americas from the rest of the world for hundreds of millions of years meant that diseases to which Europeans and Africans had built up immunities over millennia were entirely new to the native peoples of the Americas. European ships with their fleets of people and animals and plants brought along unseen battalions of diseases. Smallpox, measles, diphtheria, trachoma, whooping cough, chickenpox, bubonic plague, malaria, typhoid fever, yellow fever, dengue fever, scarlet fever, amoebic dysentery, and influenza. Diseases that had evolved alongside humans and their domesticated animals living in dense, settled populations, cities, where human and animal waste breeds vermin, like mice and rats and roaches. Most of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, though, didn't live in dense settlements, and even those who lived in villages tended to move with the seasons, taking apart their towns and rebuilding them somewhere else. They didn't accumulate filth, and they didn't live in crowds. They suffered from very few infectious diseases. Europeans exposed to these diseases for thousands of years had developed vigorous immune systems and antibodies particular to bacteria to which no one in the New World had ever been exposed. The consequence was catastrophe. Of 100 people exposed to the smallpox virus for the first time, nearly 100 became infected, and 25 to 33 died. Before they died, they exposed many more people. Smallpox incubates for 10 to 14 days, which meant that people who didn't yet feel sick tended to flee, carrying the disease as far as they could go before collapsing. Some people who were infected with smallpox could have recovered if they'd been taken care of. But when one out of every 3 people was sick, and a lot of people ran, there was no one left to nurse the sick, who died of thirst, and grief, and of being alone. And they died, too, of torture. Already weakened by disease, they were worked to death and starved to death. On the islands in the Caribbean, so many natives died so quickly that Spaniards decided very early on to conquer more territory, partly to take more prisoners to work in their gold and silver mines as slaves. Spanish conquistadors first set foot on the North American mainland in 1513. In a matter of decades, New Spain spanned not only all of what became Mexico, but also more than half of what became the continental United States, territory that stretched east to west from Florida to California, and as far north as Virginia on the Atlantic Ocean and Canada on the Pacific. Diseases spread ahead of the Spanish invaders, laying waste to wide swaths of the continent. It became commonplace, inevitable even, first among the Spanish and then in turn among the French, the Dutch, and the English, to see their own prosperity and good health and the terrible sicknesses suffered by the natives as signs from God. "Touching these savages, there is a thing I cannot omit to remark to you," one French settler wrote. "It appears visibly that God wishes that they yield their place to new peoples." Death convinced them at once of their right and of the truth of their faith. "The natives, they are all dead of smallpox," John Winthrop wrote when he arrived in New England in 1630. "The Lord hath cleared our title to what we possess." Europeans craved these omens from their God because otherwise their title to the land and their right to enslave had little foundation in the laws of men. Often this gave them pause. In 1504, the King of Spain assembled a group of scholars and lawyers to provide him with guidance about whether the conquest was in agreement with human and divine law. The debate turned on 2 questions. Did the natives own their own land, that is, did they possess dominion? And could they rule themselves, that is, did they possess sovereignty? To answer these questions, the king's advisors turned to the philosophy of antiquity. Under Roman law, government exists to manage relations of property, the king's ministers argued, and since according to Columbus, the natives had no government, they had no property, and therefore no dominion. Regarding sovereignty, the king's ministers turned to Aristotle's Politics. "That some should rule and others be ruled is a thing not only necessary but expedient, Aristotle had written. From the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. All relations are relations of hierarchy, according to Aristotle. The soul rules over the body, men over animals, males over females, and masters over slaves. Slavery, for Aristotle, was not a matter of law, but a matter of nature. He who is by nature not his own but another man's is by nature a slave, and he may be said to be another man who, being a human being, is also a possession. Those who are by nature possessions are those who have a lesser capacity for reason. These people are by nature slaves, Aristotle wrote, and it is better for them, as for all inferiors, that they should be under the rule of a master. The king was satisfied. The natives did not own their land and were by nature slaves. The conquest continued. But across the ocean, a trumpet of protest was sounded from a pulpit. In December 1511, on the fourth Sunday of Advent, Antonio de Montesinos, a Dominican priest, delivered a sermon in a church on Hispaniola. Disagreeing with the king's ministers, he said the conquistadors were committing unspeakable crimes. "Tell me, by what right or justice do you hold these Indians in such cruel and horrible slavery? By what right do you wage such detestable wars on these people who had lived mildly and peacefully in their own lands, where you have consumed infinite numbers of them with unheard of murders and desolations?" And then he asked, "Are they not men?" Out of this protest came a disquieting decision in 1513. The conquistadors would be required to read aloud to anyone they proposed to conquer and enslave a document called the Requerimiento. It is, in brief, a history of the world, from creation to conquest, a story of origins as a justification for violence. "The Lord our God, living and eternal, created the heaven and the earth, and one man and one woman, of whom you and we, all the men of the world, were and are descendants, and all those who come after us," it begins. It asks that any people to whom it was read acknowledge the church as the ruler and superior of the whole world, and the high priest called Pope, and in his name the king and queen. If the natives accepted the story of Genesis and the claim that these distant rulers had a right to rule them, the Spanish promised, "We in their name shall receive you in all love and charity, and shall leave you and your wives and your children and your lands free without servitude." But if the natives rejected these truths, the Spanish warned, "We shall forcibly enter your country, and we shall make war against you in all ways and manners that we can, and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of their highnesses. We shall take you and your wives and your children, and shall make slaves of them." With the Requerimiento in hand, with its promises of love and charity and its threats of annihilation and devastation, the Spanish marched across the North American continent. In 1519, determined to ride to glory, Hernán Cortés, mayor of Santiago, Cuba, led 600 Spaniards and more than 1,000 native allies thundering across the land with 15 cannons. In Mexico, he captured Tenochtitlan, a city said to have been grander than Paris or Rome, and destroyed it without pity or mercy. His men burned the Aztec libraries, their books of songs, their histories written down. A desolation described in a handful of surviving Icnoquiatl, songs of their sorrow. One begins, "Broken spears lie in the roads. We have torn our hair and our grief. The houses are roofless now, and their walls are red with blood." In 1540, a young nobleman named Francisco Vázquez de Coronado led an army of Spaniards who were crossing the continent in search of a fabled city of gold. In what is now New Mexico, they found a hive of baked clay apartment houses, the kind of town the Spanish took to calling a pueblo. Dutifully, Coronado had the Requerimiento read aloud. The Zuni listened to a man speaking in a language they could not possibly understand. They wore coats of iron and wore bonnets of metal and carried for weapons short canes that spit fire and made thunder, the Zuni later said about Coronado's men. Zuni warriors poured cornmeal on the ground and motioned to the Spanish that they dare not cross that line. A battle began. The Zuni, fighting with arrows, were routed by the Spaniards, who fought with guns. The conquest raged on, and so did the debate, even as the lines between the peoples of the Americas, Africa, and Europe blurred. The Spanish, unlike later English colonizers, did not travel to the New World in families or even with women. They came as armies of men. They seized and raped women, and they loved and married them and raised families together. La Malinche, a Nahua woman who was given to Cortes as a slave and who became his interpreter, had a son with him, born about 1523, the freighted symbol of a fateful union. In much of New Spain, the mixed-race children of Spanish men and Indian women, known as mestizos, outnumbered Indians. An intricate caste system marked gradations of skin color, mixtures of Europeans, Native Americans, and Africans, as if skin color were like dyes made of plants, the yellow of sassafras, the red of beets, the black of carob. Later, the English would recognize only black and white, a fantasy of stark and impossible difference, of nights without twilight and days without dawns. And yet both regimes of race, a culture of mixing, or a culture of pretending not to mix, pressed upon the brows of every person of the least curiosity the question of common humanity. Are all peoples one? Bartolomé de las Casas had been in Hispaniola as a settler in 1511, when Montesinos had preached and asked, "Are they not men?" Stirred, he'd given up his slaves and become a priest and a scholar, a historian of the conquest, which is what led him later to copy parts of Columbus's diary and Panay's Antiquities. In 1542, Las Casas wrote a book called Brevissima Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias, history not as justification, but as a cry of conscience. With the zeal of a man burdened by his own guilt, he asked, "What man of sound mind will approve a war against men who are harmless, ignorant, gentle, temperate, unarmed, and destitute of every human defense?" 8 years later, a new Spanish king summoned Las Casas and other scholars to his court in the clay-roofed city of Valladolid for another debate. Were the native peoples of the New World barbarians who had violated the laws of nature by, for instance, engaging in cannibalism, in which case it was lawful to wage war against them? Or were they innocent of these violations, in which case the war was unlawful? Las Casas argued that the conquest was unlawful, insisting that the charges of cannibalism were sheer fables and shameless nonsense. The opposing argument was made by Juan Quines de Sepúlveda, Spain's royal historian, who had never been to the New World. A translator of Aristotle, Sepúlveda, cited Aristotle's theory of natural slavery. He said that the difference between the natives and the Spaniards was as great as that between apes and men. He asked, "How are we to doubt that these people, so uncultivated, so barbarous, and so contaminated with such impiety and lewdness, have not been justly conquered?" The judges divided, failed to issue a decision. The conquest continued. Broken spears clattered to the ground, and the walls ran red with blood. To all of this, the English came remarkably late. The Spanish had settled at St. Augustine, Florida, in 1565, and by 1607 were settling the adobe town of Santa Fe, nearly 2,000 miles away. The French, who made their first voyages in 1534, were by 1608 building what would become the stone city of Quebec, a castle on a hill. The English sent John Cabot across the Atlantic in 1497, but he disappeared on his return voyage, never to be seen again, and the English gave barely any thought to sending anyone after him. The word colony didn't even enter the English language until the 1550s, and although England chartered trading companies, the Muscovy Company in 1555, the Turkey Company in 1581, and the East India Company in 1600, all looked eastward, not westward. About America, England hesitated. In 1584, Elizabeth, the fierce and determined Queen of England, asked one of her shrewdest ministers, Richard Hakluyt, whether she ought to found her own colonies in the Americas. She had in mind the Spanish and their idolatries and their cruelties and their vast riches and their tyranny. By the time Elizabeth began staring west across the ocean, Las Casas's pained history of the conquest had long since been translated into English, lavishly illustrated with engravings of atrocities, often under the title Spanish Cruelties, and, later, as the Tears of the Indians. The English had come to believe, as an article of faith, as a matter of belonging to the English nation, that they were nobler than the Spanish, more just, wiser, gentler, and dedicated to liberty. "The Spaniards govern in the Indies with all pride and tyranny," Hakluyt reminded his queen. "And as with any people who are made slaves, the natives all yell and cry with one voice, 'Liberta, Liberta!' England could deliver them." England's notion of itself as a land of liberty was the story of the English nation stitched to the story of the English state. The Spanish were Catholic, but while conquistadors had been building a new Spain, the English had become Protestant. In the 1530s, Henry VIII had established the Church of England, defiantly separate from the Church of Rome. Occupied with religious and domestic affairs, England had been altogether tentative in venturing forth to the New World. When Henry VIII died in 1547, his son Edward became king. But by 1552, Edward was mortally ill. Hoping to avoid the ascension of his half-sister Mary, who was a Catholic, Edward named as his successor his cousin, Lady Jane Grey. But when Edward died, Mary seized power, had Jane beheaded, and became the first ruling queen of England. She attempted to restore Catholicism and persecuted religious dissenters, nearly 300 of whom were burned at the stake. Protestants who opposed her rule on religious grounds decided to argue that she had no right to reign because she was a woman, claiming that for the weak to govern the strong was the subversion of good order. Another of Mary's Protestant critics complained that her reign was a punishment from God, "who hast set to rule over us a woman, whom nature hath formed to be in subjection unto man." Mary's Catholic defenders, meanwhile, argued that, politically speaking, Mary was a man, the prince female. When Mary died in 1558, Elizabeth, a Protestant, succeeded her, and Mary's supporters, who had tried to argue against Elizabeth's right to rule, were left to battle against their own earlier arguments. They couldn't very well argue that Elizabeth couldn't rule because she was a woman, when they had earlier insisted that her sex did not bar Mary from the throne. The debate moved to new terrain and clarified a number of English ideas about the nature of rule. Elizabeth's best defender argued that if God decided the female should rule and govern, it didn't matter that women were weak in nature, feeble in body, soft in courage, because God would make every right ruler strong. In any case, England's constitution abided by a rule mixed, in which the authority of the monarchy was checked by the power of Parliament. Also, it is not she that ruleth, but the laws. Elizabeth herself called on yet another authority, the favor of the people. A mixed constitution, the rule of law, the will of the people, these were English ideas that Americans would one day make their own, crying, "Liberty!" Elizabeth eyed Spain, which had been warring with England, France, and a rebelling Netherlands. The Dutch did not achieve independence from Spain until 1609. She set out to fight Spain on every field. On the question of founding colonies in the Americas, Hakluyt submitted to Elizabeth a report that he titled, "A Particular Discourse Concerning the Great Necessity and Manifold Commodities that are like to grow to this realm of England by the Western discoveries lately attempted." How much the Queen was animated by animosity to Spain is nicely illustrated in the title of a report submitted to her at the very same time by another advisor. "A Discourse How Her Majesty May Annoy the King of Spain." Hakluyt believed that the time had come for England to do more than attack Spanish ships. "Establishing colonies will be greatly for the enlargement of the gospel of Christ," he promised, "and will yield unto us all the commodities of Europe, Africa, and Asia." And if the Queen of England were to plant colonies in the New World, word would soon spread that the English used the natural people there with all humanity, courtesy, and freedom, and the natives would yield themselves to her government and revolt clean from the Spaniard. England would prosper, Protestantism would conquer Catholicism, liberty would conquer tyranny. Elizabeth was unpersuaded. She was also distracted. In 1584, she'd expelled the Spanish ambassador, after discovering a Spanish plot to invade England by way of Scotland. She liked the idea of an English foothold in the New World, but she didn't want the crown to cover the cost. She decided to issue a royal patent, a license, to one of her favorite courtiers, the dashing Walter Raleigh, writer, poet, and spy, granting him the right to land in North America, south of a place called Newfoundland, a newfound land, a new world, a utopia, a once nowhere. Raleigh was an adventurer, a man of action, but he was also a man of letters. Newly knighted, he launched an expedition in 1584. He did not sail himself, but sent out a fleet of 7 ships and 600 men, providing them with a copy of Las Casas's Book of Spanish Cruelties with fair pictures, to be used to convince the natives that the English, unlike the Spanish, were men of mercy and love, liberty and charity. Raleigh may well also have sent along with his expedition a copy of a new book of essays by the French philosopher Michel de Montaigne. Like William Shakespeare, Raleigh was deeply influenced by Montaigne, whose 1580 essay of Cannibals testifies to how, in one of the more startling ironies in the history of humanity, the very violence that characterized the meeting between one half the world and the other, which sowed so much destruction, also carried within it the seeds of something else. "Barbarians are no more marvelous to us than we are to them, nor for better cause," Montaigne wrote. "Each man calls barbarism whatever is not his own practice. They are to us as we are to them, each true, out of 2 truths, 1. Raleigh's men made landfall on an island on the outer banks of what is now North Carolina, sweeping beaches edged with seagrass and stands of pine trees and palms. The ship sailed away, leaving behind 104 men with very little by way of supplies. The supply ship had been damaged, nearly running aground on the shoals. The site had been chosen because it was well hidden and difficult to reach. It may have been a good hideout for pirates, but it was a terrible place to build a colony. The settlers planned to wait out the winter, awaiting supplies they hoped would arrive in the spring. Meanwhile, they intended to look for gold and for a safer, deeper harbor. They built a fort surrounded by palisades. They aimed its guns out over the wide water, believing their enemy to be Spain. They built houses outside the protection of the fort. They had very little idea that the people who already lived in the Outer Banks might pose a danger to them. They sent home glowing reports of a land of ravishing beauty and staggering plenty. Ralph Lane, the head of the expedition, wrote that all the kingdoms and states of Christendom, their commodities joined in one together, do not yield either more good or more plentiful whatsoever for public use as needful or pleasing for delight. Yet when the supply ship was delayed, the colonists, in the midst of plenty, began to starve. The natives, to whom the colonists had been preaching the gospel, began telling them, "Our Lord was not God, since he suffered us to sustain much hunger." In June, a fleet arrived, commanded by Sir Francis Drake, a swashbuckler who'd sailed across the whole of the globe. He carried a cargo of 300 Africans bound in chains. Drake told the colonists that either he could leave them with food and with a ship to look for a safer harbor, or else he could bring them home. Every colonist opted to leave. On Drake's ships, they took the place of the Africans, people that Drake may have simply dumped into the Cobalt Sea, unwanted cargo. Another expedition sent in 1587 to what had come to be called Roanoke fared no better. John White, an artist and mapmaker who had carefully studied the reports of the first expedition, aimed to establish a permanent colony, not on the island, but in nearby Chesapeake Bay, in a city to be called Raleigh. Instead, one blunder followed another. White sailed back to England that fall in hopes of securing supplies and support. His timing could hardly have been less propitious. In 1588, a fleet of 150 Spanish ships attempted to invade England. Eventually, the Armada was defeated, but with a naval war with Spain raging, White had no success in scaring up more ships to sail to Roanoke, leaving the settlement marooned. Any record of the fate of the English colony at Roanoke, like most of what has ever happened in the history of the world, was lost. When White finally returned in 1590, he found not a single Englishman, nor his daughter, nor his grandchild, a baby named Virginia, after Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. Nearly all that remained of the settlement were the letters C-R-O, carved into the trunk of a tree, a sign that White and the colonists had agreed upon before he left, a sign that they'd packed their things and headed inland to find a better site to settle. Three letters, and not one letter more. They were never heard from again. We found the people most gentle, loving, and faithful, void of all guile and treason, and such as lived after the manner of the Golden Age. Arthur Barlow, one of Raleigh's captains, had earlier written home, describing Roanoke as a kind of Eden. The natives weren't barbarians, they were ancestors, and the New World was the oldest world of all. In the brutal, bloody century between Columbus's voyage and John White's, an idea was born, out of fantasy, out of violence. The idea that there exists in the world a people who live in an actual Garden of Eden, a state of nature, before the giving of laws, before the forming of government. This imagined history of America became an English book of Genesis, their new truth. In the beginning, the Englishman John Locke would write, all the world was America. In America, everything became a beginning. Chapter 2, The Rulers and the Ruled. They skinned the deer with knives made of stone and scraped the hides of flesh with the fat of a rib bone. They soaked the hides in wood ash and corn mash and stretched them on a frame of sticks before sewing them together with thread made of tendons twisted. Onto these stitched and tanned hides, they embroidered hundreds of tiny shells of seashore snails, emptied and dried, into the pattern of a man, flanked by a white-tailed deer and a mountain lion in a field of 34 circles. This man was their ruler, the animals his spirits, and the circles the villages over which he ruled. One of his names was Wahunsekok, but the English called him Powhatan. He may have worn the deerskin as a cloak, he may have used it to honor his ancestors. He may have given it to the English as a gift in 1608, when their king, James, sent to him the gift of a scarlet robe, one robe for another. Or the English might have stolen it. Somehow, someone carried it to England on a ship. In 1638, an Englishman who saw it in a museum in England called the sinew-stitched deerskin decorated with shells the robe of the King of Virginia. But if it was Powhatan's cloak, it also served as a map of his realm. The English called Powhatan king for the sake of diplomacy, but it was the King of England who claimed to be the King of Virginia. James considered Powhatan among his subjects. The nature and history of the two kings' reigns cast light on matters with which England's colonists would wrestle for more than a century and a half. Who rules, and by what right? Powhatan was born about 1545. At the death of his father, he inherited rule over six neighboring peoples. In the 1590s, he'd begun expanding his reign. On the other side of the ocean, James was born in 1566. The next year, when his mother died, he became King of Scotland. In 1603, after the death of his cousin, Elizabeth, James was crowned King of England. The separation of the Church of England from the Church of Rome had elevated the monarchy, since the king no longer answered to the Pope, and James believed that he, like the Pope, was divinely appointed by God. "As to dispute what God may do is blasphemy," he wrote in a treatise called The True Law of Free Monarchies, "so it is sedition in subjects to dispute what a king may do," as if he were both infallible and above the rule of law. James, a Pope-like king, proved more determined to found a colony in the New World than Elizabeth had been. In 1606, he issued a charter, granting to a body of men permission to settle on that part of America commonly called Virginia, land that he claimed as his property, since, as the charter explained, these lands were not now actually possessed by any Christian prince or people, and the natives live in darkness, meaning that they did not know Christ. Unlike the Spanish who set out to conquer, the English were determined to settle, which is why they at first traded with Powhatan instead of warring with him. James granted to the colony's settlers the right to dig, mine, and search for all manner of mines of gold, silver, and copper, the very kind of initiatives taken by Spain. But he also urged them to convert the natives to Christianity on the ground that, in propagating the Christian religion to such people, the English and Scottish might, in time, bring the infidels and savages living in these parts to human civility and to a settled and quiet government. They proposed, he insisted, to bring not tyranny, but liberty. James's charter, like Powhatan's deerskin, is also a kind of map. Charter has the same Latin root as chart, meaning a map. By his charter, James granted land to two corporations, the Virginia Company and the Plymouth Company. "We would vouchsafe unto them our license to make habitation, plantation, and to deduce a colony at any place upon the said coast of Virginia or America where they shall think fit and convenient." Virginia at the time stretched from what is now South Carolina to Canada. All of this England claimed. England's empire would have a different character than that of either Spain or France. Catholics could make converts by the act of baptism, but Protestants were supposed to teach converts to read the Bible. That meant permanent settlements, families, communities, schools, and churches. Also, England's empire would be maritime. Its navy was its greatest strength. It would be commercial. And of greatest significance for the course of the nation that would grow out of those settlements, its colonists would be free men, not vassals, guaranteed their English liberties. At such a great distance from their king, James's colonists would remain his subjects, but they would rule themselves. His 1606 charter decreed that the king would appoint a 13-man council in England to oversee the colonies, but as for local affairs, the settlers would establish their own 13-man council to govern and order all matters and causes. And most importantly, the colonists would retain all of their rights as English subjects, as if they had never left England. If the king meant his guarantee of the colonists' English liberties, privileges, and immunities as liberties, privileges, and immunities due to them if they were to return to England, the colonists would come to understand them as guaranteed in the colonies a freedom attached to their very selves. Over the course of the 17th and early 18th centuries, the English established more than two dozen colonies, founding a seaborne empire of coastal settlements that stretched from the fishing ports of Newfoundland to the rice fields of Georgia, and in the Caribbean from Jamaica and Antigua to Bermuda and Barbados. Beginning with the Virginia Charter, the idea of English liberties for English subjects was planted on American soil, and with it, the king's claim to dominion, a claim that rested on the idea that people like Powhatan and his people lived in darkness and without government, no matter that the English called their leaders kings. And yet, England's own political order was about to be toppled. At the beginning of English colonization, the king's subjects on both sides of the ocean believed that men were created unequal and that God had granted to their king the right to rule over them. These were their old truths. At the end of the 17th century, John Locke, imagining an American Genesis and borrowing from Christian theology, would argue that all men were born into a state of equality, wherein all the power and jurisdiction is reciprocal, no one having more than another, each equal to the greatest and subject to nobody. By 1776, many of the king's subjects in many of his colonies so wholly agreed with this point of view that they accepted Thomas Paine's plain truth, that all men being originally equals, nothing was more absurd than the idea that God had granted to one person and his heirs the right to rule over all others. "Nature disproves it," Paine insisted. "Otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion." These became their new truths. What had happened between the Virginia Charter and the Declaration of Independence to convince so many people that all men are created equal and that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed? The answer lies in artifacts as different as a deerskin cloak and a scarlet robe, and in places as far from one another as the ruins of ancient castles and the hulls of slave ships, each haunted by the rattling of iron-forged chains. 1. Virginia's first charter was prepared in the office of Attorney General Edward Cook, a sour-tempered man with a pointed chin, a systematic mind, and an ungovernable tongue. Cook, who invested in the Virginia Company, was the leading theorist of English common law, the body of unwritten law established by centuries of custom and cases, to which Cook sought to apply the precepts of rationalism. "Reason is the life of the law," Cook wrote, "and the common law itself is nothing else but reason." In 1589, when he was 37, Cook became a member of Parliament. 5 years later, Elizabeth appointed him Attorney General. In 1603, after James threw Sir Walter Raleigh in the Tower of London, Cook prosecuted Raleigh for treason, for plotting against the king. "Thou viper," Cook said to Raleigh in court, "thou hast an English face but a Spanish heart." Raleigh languished in prison for 13 years, writing his History of the World, before he was beheaded. Meanwhile, his conviction freed the right to settle Virginia, a right Elizabeth had granted to Raleigh, to be newly issued by James, under Cook's watchful eye. 2 months after issuing the colony's charter, James appointed Cook Chief Justice of the Court of Common Pleas. To settle the new colony, the Virginia Company rounded up men who were eager to make their own fortunes, along with soldiers who'd fought in England's religious wars against Catholics and Muslims. Burly and fearless John Smith, all of 26, had already fought the Spanish in France and in the Netherlands, and, with the Austrian army, had battled the Turks in Hungary. Captured by Muslims, he'd been sold into slavery, from which he'd eventually escaped. Engraved on his coat of arms, with three heads of Turks, was his motto, "Vincere est vivere," to conquer is to live. George Sands, Virginia's treasurer, had traveled by camel to Jerusalem and had written at length about Islam. William Strachey, the colony's secretary, had traveled in Istanbul. Much like the Spanish, these men and their investors wanted to found a colony in the New World to search for gold, to fund wars to defeat Muslims in the Old World, even if they pledged not to inflict Spanish cruelties on the American natives. In December 1606, 105 Englishmen, and no women, boarded three ships, carrying a box containing a list of the men appointed by the Virginia Company to govern the colony, not to be opened nor the governors known until they arrived in Virginia. During the voyage, Smith was confined below decks, shackled and in chains, accused of plotting a mutiny to make himself king. In May 1607, when the expedition finally landed on the banks of a brackish river named after their king, the box was opened, and it was discovered that Smith, though still a prisoner, was on that list. Unclapped came his chains. Whatever quiet government the company's merchants had intended, the colonists proved ungovernable. They built a fort and began looking for gold, but a band of soldiers and gentlemen adventurers proved unwilling to clear fields or plant and harvest crops. Instead, they stole food from Powhatan's people, stores of corn and beans. Smith, disgusted, complained that the company had sent hardly any but the most useless of settlers. He counted one carpenter, two blacksmiths, and a flock of footmen, and wrote the rest off as gentlemen tradesmen, serving men, libertines, and such like, 10 times more fit to spoil a commonwealth than either begin one, but help to maintain one. In 1608, Smith elected the colony's governor, made a rule, "He who does not work shall not eat." By way of diplomacy, he staged an elaborate coronation ceremony, crowning Powhatan king and draping upon his shoulders the scarlet robe sent by James. Whatever this gesture meant to Powhatan, the English intended it as an act of their sovereignty, insisting that in accepting these gifts, Powhatan had submitted to English rule. Powhatan, their chief king, received voluntarily a crown and a scepter with a full acknowledgement of duty and submission. And still the English starved, and still they raided native villages. In the fall of 1609, the colonists revolted, auguring so many revolts to come, and sent Smith back to England, declaring that he had made Virginia, under his leadership, a misery, a ruin, a death, a hell. The real hell was yet to come. In the winter of 1609-10, 500 colonists, having failed to farm or fish or hunt, and having succeeded at little except making their neighbors into enemies, were reduced to 60. Many, through extreme hunger, have run out of their naked beds, being so lean that they look like anatomies crying out, "We are starved! We are starved!" wrote the colony's Lieutenant Governor George Percy, the eighth son of the Earl of Northumberland, reporting that one of our colony murdered his wife, ripped the child out of her womb and threw it into the river, and after chopped the mother in pieces and salted her for his food. They ate one another. Word of this dire state of affairs soon reached England. Like nearly everything else reported from across the ocean, it set minds alight. The philosopher, Thomas Hobbes, who served on the board of the Virginia Company, eyed the descent of the colony into anarchy with more than passing interest. In 1622, 4 years after Powhatan's death, the natives rose up in rebellion and tried to oust the English from their land, killing hundreds of new immigrants in what the English called the Virginia Massacre. Hobbes, working out a theory of the origins of civil society by deducing an original state of nature, pondered the violence in Virginia. "The savage people in many places of America have no government at all and live at this day in that brutish manner," he would later write in The Leviathan, a treatise in which he concluded that the state of nature is a state of war, of every man against every man. Miraculously, the colony recovered, its population grew, and its economy thrived with a new crop, tobacco, a plant found only in the New World and long cultivated by the natives. With tobacco came the prospect of profit and a new political and economic order. The colonists would rule themselves, and they would rule over others. In July 1619, 22 English colonists, 2 men from each of 11 parts of the colony, met in a legislative body, the House of Burgesses, the first self-governing body in the colonies. 1 month later, 20 Africans arrived in Virginia, the first slaves in British America, Kimbundu speakers from the kingdom of Ndongo. Captured in raids ordered by the governor of Angola, they had been marched to the coast and boarded the São João Bautista, a Portuguese slave ship headed for New Spain. At sea, an English privateer, the White Lion, sailing from New Netherlands, attacked the São João Bautista, seized all 20, and brought them to Virginia to be sold. 20 Englishmen were elected to the House of Burgesses. 20 Africans were condemned to the House of Bondage. Another chapter opened in the American Book of Genesis. Liberty and slavery became the American Abel and Cain. 2. Waves slapped against the hulls of ships like the pounding of a drum. Mothers lulled children to sleep while men wailed, singing songs of sorrow. It frequently happens that the Negroes, on being purchased by the Europeans, become raving mad, wrote one slave trader. Many of them die in that state. Others took their own lives, throwing themselves into the sea, hoping that the ocean would carry them to their ancestors. The English who crossed the ocean endured the hazards of the voyage under altogether different circumstances, but the perils of the passage left their traces on them, too, in memoirs and stories, and in their bonds to one another. In the summer of 1620, a year after the White Lion landed off the coast of Virginia, the Mayflower, 180-ton, three-masted, square-rigged merchant vessel, lay anchored in the harbor of the English town of Plymouth, at the mouth of the River Plym. It soon took on its passengers, some 60 adventurers and 41 men, dissenters from the Church of England, who brought with them their wives, children, and servants. William Bradford, the dissenter's chronicler, called them pilgrims. Bradford, who would become governor of the colony the dissenters would found, became, too, its chief historian. Writing, he said, in a plain style, with singular regard unto the simple truth in all things. 10 years before, Bradford explained, the pilgrims had left England for Holland, where they'd settled in Leiden, a university town known for learning and for religious toleration. After a decade in exile, they decided to make a new start someplace else. The place they had thoughts on was some of those vast and unpeopled countries of America, Bradford wrote, which are fruitful and fit for habitation, being devoid of all civil inhabitants, where there are only savage and brutish men, which range up and down, little otherwise than the wild beasts. Though fearful of the journey, they placed their faith in a providential God and set sail for Virginia. All things being compact together in one ship, Bradford wrote, they put to sea again with a prosperous wind. During the treacherous 66-day journey over what Bradford called the vast and furious ocean, one man was swept overboard, saved only by grasping a halyard. The ship leaked, a beam split, and one of the masts bowed and nearly cracked. For 2 days, the wind grew so fierce that everyone on board had to crowd into the hull, huddled under rafters. When the storm quieted, the crew caulked the decks, fortified the masts, and raised the sails once more. Elizabeth Hopkins gave birth on the swaying ship. She named her son Oceanus. The ship, blown severely off course, dropped anchor, not in Virginia, but off the windswept coast of Cape Cod. Unwilling to risk the ocean again, the pilgrims rowed ashore to found what they hoped would be a new and better England, another beginning. And yet, wrote Bradford, what could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness full of wild beasts and wild men? They fell to their knees and praised God they were alive. The day they arrived, having sailed what Bradford described as a sea of troubles, in a ship they imagined as a ship of state, the whole body of a people in the same boat, they signed a document in which they pledged to covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic. They named their agreement after their ship. They called it the Mayflower Compact. The men who settled Virginia had been granted a charter by their king, but the men, women, and children who settled in what they called a New England had no charter. They'd fled the king, bridling against his rule. Religious dissent in 17th century England was also a form of political dissent. It was punishable by both imprisonment and execution. But if James's divine right to rule was questioned by dissenters who fled his authority, it was being questioned, too, on the floor of Parliament. The battle between the king and Parliament would send tens of thousands more exiles across the vast and furious ocean, seeking political freedom in the colonies. It would also foster in them a deep and abiding spirit of rebellion against arbitrary rule. Even as dissenters in New England struggled to survive their first winter in a settlement they named Plymouth, members of Parliament were beginning to challenge the tradition by which Parliament met only when summoned by the king. In 1621, Edward Cook, who after Raleigh's beheading in 1618 had emerged as James's most cunning adversary, claimed that Parliament had the right to debate on all matters concerning the Commonwealth. The king had Cook arrested, confined him to the Tower of London, and dissolved Parliament. Raleigh had written a history of the world while in prison. Cook would write a history of the law. To build his case against the king, Cook dusted off a copy of an ancient and almost entirely forgotten legal document known as Magna Carta, literally the Great Charter, in which, in the year 1215, King John had pledged to his barons that he would obey the law of the land. Magna Carta wasn't nearly as important as Cook made it out to be, but by arguing for its importance, he made it important, not only for English history, but for American history too, tying the political fate of everyone in England's colonies to the strange doings of a very bad king from the Middle Ages. King John, born in 1166, was the youngest son of Henry II. As a young man, he'd studied with his father's chief minister, Ranulf de Glanville, who had dedicated himself to preparing one of the earliest commentaries on the English law, in which he had attempted to address the rather delicate question of whether a law can be a law if no one had ever written it down. It would be utterly impossible for the law and rules of the realm to be reduced to writing, Glanville admitted. That said, unwritten laws are still laws, he insisted. They are a body of custom and precedent that together constitute common law. Glanville's ruminations had led him to another and even more delicate question. If the law isn't written down, and even if it is, by what argument or force can a king be constrained to obey it? Kings had insisted on their right to rule in writing since the 6th century BC, and at least since the 9th century AD, they'd been binding themselves to the administration of justice by taking oaths. In 1100, in the Charter of Liberties, Henry I, the son of William the Conqueror, promised to abolish all the evil customs by which the Kingdom of England has been unjustly oppressed, which, while not a promise he kept, set a precedent that Glanville might have expected would act to restrain Henry I's grandson, King John. Unfortunately, King John proved a tyrant, heedless of the Charter of Liberties. He levied taxes higher than any king ever had before, and either carried so much coin outside his realm or kept so much of it in his castle that it was difficult for anyone to pay him with money. When his noblemen fell into his debt, he took their sons hostage. He had one noblewoman and her son starved to death in a dungeon. Rumor had it that he ordered one of his clerks crushed to death. In 1215, barons rebelling against the king captured the Tower of London. When John agreed to meet with them to negotiate a peace, and they gathered at Runnymede, a meadow by the Thames, the barons presented him with a very long list of demands, which were rewritten as a charter, in which the king granted to all free men in his realm, that is, not to the people, but to noblemen, all the liberties written out below, to have and to keep for them and their heirs of us and our heirs. This was the Great Charter, the Magna Carta. Magna Carta had been revoked almost immediately after it was written, and it had become altogether obscure by the time of King James and his battles with the ungovernable Edward Coke. But Coke, as brilliant a political strategist as he was a legal scholar, resurrected it in the 1620s and began calling it England's ancient constitution. When James insisted on his sovereignty, an ancient authority by which the monarch is above the law, Coke, countering with his ancient constitution, insisted that the law was above the king. "Magna Carta is such a fellow," Coke said, "that he will have no sovereign." Coke's resurrection of Magna Carta explains a great deal about how it is that some English colonists would one day come to believe that their king had no right to rule them, and why their descendants would come to believe that the United States needed a written constitution. But Magna Carta played one further pivotal role, the role it played in the history of truth, a history that had taken a different course in England than in any other part of Europe. The most crucial right established under Magna Carta was the right to a trial by jury. For centuries, guilt or innocence had been determined across Europe, either by a trial by ordeal, a trial by water, for instance, or a trial by fire, or a trial by combat. Trials by ordeal or combat required neither testimony nor questioning. The outcome was itself the evidence, the only admissible form of judicial proof, accepted because it placed judgment in the hands of God. Nevertheless, the practice was easily abused. Priests, after all, could be bribed. And in 1215, the Pope banned trial by ordeal. In Europe, it was replaced by a new system of divine judgment, judicial torture. But in England, where there existed a tradition of convening juries to judge civil disputes, like disagreements over boundaries between neighboring freeholds, trial by ordeal was replaced not by judicial torture, but by trial by jury. One reason this happened is because the very year that the Pope abolished trial by ordeal, King John pledged, in Magna Carta, that no free man is to be arrested or imprisoned save by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. In England, truth in either a civil dispute or a criminal investigation would be determined not by God but by men, and not by a battle of swords but by a battle of facts. This turn marked the beginning of a new era in the history of knowledge. It required a new doctrine of evidence and a new method of inquiry, and eventually led to the idea that an observed or witness act or thing, the substance, the matter of fact, is the basis of truth. A judge decided the law, a jury decided the facts. Mysteries were matters of faith, a different kind of truth, known only to God. But when, during the Reformation, the Church of England separated from the Roman Catholic Church, protesting the authority of the Pope and finding truth in the Bible, the mysteries of the Church were thrown open, the secrets of priests revealed. The age of mystery began to wane, and soon the culture of fact spread from law to government. In 17th century England, the meat of the matter between the king and parliament was a dispute over the nature of knowledge. King James, citing divine right, insisted that his power could not be questioned, and that it lay outside the realm of facts. "That which concerns the mystery of the king's power is not lawful to be disputed," he said. To dispute the divine right of kings was to remove the king's power from the realm of mystery, the realm of religion and faith, and place it in the realm of fact, the realm of evidence and trial. To grant to the colonies a charter was to establish law on a foundation of fact, a repudiation of government by mystery. By what right did the king rule, and how might Parliament constrain him? After James died in 1625, his son Charles was crowned king, But Charles, too, believed in the divine right of kings. 3 years later, Cook, now 76, and having returned to Parliament, objected to Charles's exerting his royal prerogative to billet soldiers in his subjects' homes and to confine men to jail without trial for refusing to pay taxes. Cook claimed that the king's authority was constrained by Magna Carta. At Cook's suggestion, Parliament then prepared and delivered to Charles a petition of right,